Don't drink coffee? Don't eat fat? Eggs are bad for you. Is that really what the science says?
Often when people are speaking to you with authority about what you should or should not be eating, they're relying on studies that don't have the kind of weight behind them that they should, given the authority with which the proclamations about what you should or should not eat.
That's Dr. Aaron Carroll. We talk with him about his book, The Bad Food Bible, How and Why to Eat Sinfully. Then, the American diet is dominated by processed food. It's bad for us, but why?
So when you think of processed foods, it's not just one thing. It's first, stripping of its nutrition. Second, all the additives that are added to the crop that was grown. Then the plastic packaging. And then on top of that, whatever food additives were, you know, kinds of like preservatives and colorings and all these other things that are added to the foods.
That's Kristen Lawless. Her book is Formerly Known as Food, How the Industrial Food System is Changing Our Minds, Bodies, and Culture. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Advice about food can be confusing. There's usually only one thing experts can agree on. Some ingredients, often the ones we enjoy the most, are bad for you. Full stop. But as my guest Aaron Carroll explains, these oversimplifications are wrong and dangerous. If we stop consuming some of our most demonized ingredients completely, it may actually hurt us. In the Bad Food Bible, Carroll examines the scientific evidence, showing, among other things that you can eat, are red meat several times a week, drink as much coffee as you want, have a drink a day, and eat more salt. Aaron Carroll is a doctor and a contributor to the New York Times Upshot column. Next up, what's up with processed food, even if it's organic? Stay tuned after the break. Dr. Aaron Carroll, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
This book teaches the reader how to think about science better, not just nutrition, because it really teaches the reader how to evaluate the different kinds of studies. You say there one of the biggest problems has been that all the research, the good research, the bad research, has all been stirred into one big pot. Tell us a little bit about what are the main pitfalls of some of the research that's been done that readers need to be alert to.
Well, this is true not only just of nutrition research, but all research in general. Part of the problem is that whenever you sort of confront anything that's said, especially with respect to food, someone will say, oh, but a research says, or a study says. But not all studies are the same, and not all research is equivalent. And to sort of lump it all together in one pile, as you said, is a real problem. With respect to nutrition, a lot of the work that's been done, especially in trying to show the dangers, is first of all on animals or just on sort of chemicals in a lab. And if it is animals, it's often almost genetically identical male mice, because of course scientists often won't even use female mice, because then they have to deal with hormones and cycles and things that might confound their research. So you wind up taking research on small numbers of one sex of one species of mice and then trying to extrapolate it to all of humanity. That's problematic, if for no other reason than, you know, it's much more complicated to talk about how humans eat and how they diet than it is to talk about mice, which you can control completely. Even if you get beyond that, a lot of the research with respect to humans is what we would call retrospective, or a cohort study, or even a case control study, where really what we're doing is saying we have groups of people, some people have a disease or a problem, some people don't, and then we try to just see, do they differ in some way with respect to what they eat? And even if you find something positive there, it's not proven that that's causal. It could just be an association. It could be that, you know, people who tend to eat a certain way also tend to do other things which are unhealthy. Perhaps they smoke. Perhaps they don't exercise. Perhaps they live in a climate or an area that leaves them more predisposed to problems. So the only kinds of studies that are really good for documenting causality, for proving that one thing causes another, are what we call controlled trials or randomized controlled trials. Those are very rare in nutrition. If they happen, they're almost always very short-term, like weeks. And then again, to try to extrapolate that to what happens to human beings over long periods of time with respect to their diet, there really just aren't that many of them. And so often when people are speaking to you with authority about what you should or should not be eating, they're relying on studies that don't have the kind of weight behind them that they should, given the authority with which the proclamations about what you should or should not eat. And unfortunately, getting through to the nuances of all of those studies is difficult. I'd only point out one more thing. Part of the way, unfortunately, the media treats a lot of research in science and nutrition as well, is that each new proclamation, each new study is treated as if it exists in a vacuum, as if nothing was known before, and that it changes all that we know about food and what we should or should not be eating. Those studies are almost always scary and bad, because those are the kinds of studies which are more likely to get publicized. But unless they're placed holistically with all the other research that's come before, you're not being fed the full story. Because, of course, if there's a lot of research which shows we really don't know one way or the other what's true, to take one more new tiny study and say, well, that overturns all that's come before is ridiculous. But too often, that's how we treat new studies about food.
And isn't that why you recommend, I guess what it's called, meta-analysis, something that looks at all the studies?
The best kinds of studies for looking at all of these things, in fact, almost all of my columns try to promote this as well, is what we would either call systematic reviews or meta-analyses. Those are studies of studies. So a systematic review basically commits to collecting all of the good research on a topic. If you said, you know, what's the relationship between coffee and cancer? A systematic review would look for every single study that has ever been done, setting strict criteria for what should be considered good or bad, including them all, placing them all together, telling you what it means. A meta-analysis goes one step further. It usually takes a systematic review and then conducts analyses on them. So instead of having 25 small studies, it lumps all the data together and treats it as one huge study and tries to give you statistics for what all of the studies tell us together. So in an ideal world, and in fact we often have them, you want to hear about systematic reviews or meta-analyses. And if a meta-analysis has been done on a topic, then one more new tiny study shouldn't be viewed as a new news story unless it's been added to everything that's come before in the meta-analysis. Unfortunately, that rarely happens with respect to science coverage in the lay media.
Could you give us an example of something where there were an idea about something being bad for you? For example, eggs and cholesterol, where meta-analysis showed something different.
Well, I think that's a perfect example. So we had in the past, you know, lots of studies that, well, first of all, we just had a general understanding that, of course, cholesterol in your blood was bad for you. If you had especially high levels of bad cholesterol in your blood, it made it more likely to build up plaques, more likely to have a heart disease, and perhaps a heart attack, and that you would die. And then it became sort of common wisdom that, of course, well, if high cholesterol in your blood is bad for you, then we must be afraid of eating cholesterol. And they could do studies which showed them, well, people that tended to eat diets that were high in cholesterol also might have had tended to have diet, you know, serum cholesterol that was too high, so therefore one must cause the other. But then later, they started doing individual randomized controlled trials where they said, okay, let's take a group of people and we will give some of them eggs every day and we will give others no eggs and we will see how this changes their cholesterol. And when we did that kind of study, they didn't get the results that they expected. They found that, well, there were really minor changes, if any at all, with respect to how much your cholesterol fluctuated depending upon how much you ate. Later, they did systematic reviews or meta-analyses where they gathered up all of these studies together, and what they found was that there's almost no relationship between the cholesterol that you eat and the cholesterol in your blood, that most of the cholesterol in your blood is actually made by your liver, that how much cholesterol you consume doesn't affect the cholesterol in your blood. So much so that in the last set of USDA guidelines in 2015, they finally changed the recommendation on cholesterol and said it's no longer a nutrient of concern, meaning that you don't need to worry about the eating cholesterol with respect to the cholesterol in your blood. So that's a huge sea change. I mean, when I was growing up, it was like you could not eat eggs. You'd eat egg white omelets. They came up with egg beaters. They found up all kinds of ways to keep you from getting the cholesterol in eggs. And now, basically, they're saying that for the vast, vast majority of people, that's not a concern anymore, that other things might be concerning with respect to what might raise your cholesterol levels, like saturated fat, although the the jury's still out on that total, not entirely, but that you don't need to worry about the cholesterol or the eggs that you eat anymore.
And you did mention saturated fat. In fact, I remember just recently, you know, reading a column in the New York Times saying once again that saturated fat is bad for you and you should limit meat. You spend a fair amount of ink on this issue, even though you say the jury's out, you say that not all saturated fats are the same.
No, but that's part of it, too, is that like people have sort of revisionist history with how they look at fat as well. It was very clear that in the 60s and 70s, even into the 80s, low-fat diets were being pushed, and that included both saturated fat and unsaturated fat. And, of course, if you eliminate saturated and unsaturated fat from your diet, and, of course, that leads to also eliminating lots of meat which contain those fats, then you're left with carbs. And now, of course, we're saying, whoa, that was not such a good idea. All of this turning to carbs probably led to a significant amount of obesity, and so now we're pushing back against carbohydrates. You got to eat something. And so today the common wisdom is like, okay, look, you don't really need to limit unsaturated fat at all, but you should probably limit your saturated fat. But you don't want to replace that saturated fat with carbs. You want to replace it with unsaturated fat and perhaps with protein. And it gets all of this complicated. And even that isn't as proven in studies as people would have you believe. So the evidence against unsaturated fat has really gone away for the most part. In fact, even a lot of the really, truly anti-fat crusaders will now say, well, you know, even unsaturated fat is probably fine. There's lots of good fats. But they will still often point to saturated fat and say, avoid that like the plague, however. But the evidence against it is still not a slam dunk that people would have you believe. And even then, it's not at 0%. The danger is, of course, when you're over-consuming it or eating too much of it, that's a different message. And it's nuanced. And a lot of people think that the general public can't handle nuance. I like to think they're better than that, that we can have a reasonable discussion about moderation in understanding that you don't want to overdo it on any certain type of food, but the completely eliminating it from your diet is also not necessary.
And we could point out that on the other end of the spectrum, there are folks who say that you should be eating things like butter and, or even meats, people who are into low-carb diets, because they say they fulfill you more. So, you know, what's an eater to do?
So here's the thing about all diets. All diets essentially work about the same. You lose weight initially, then you plateau, and then you wind up gaining a lot of it back, if not even more. That is true of low-carb diets. It's true of low-fat diets. There is no truth or proof yet that proves that any one of these diets is completely superior to the other. Moreover, lots of them fail with respect to dieting in the sense that they don't produce long-lasting change. I think part of that is because so many of them are based on abstention, and they are based on trying to get you into eating patterns that are not sustainable over the long haul, that eventually you can't keep up this total avoiding of one food or another. And nutritional guidelines have been slow to react to this. Unfortunately, still a lot of them are very prescriptive in telling you how much of each thing to eat every day. They're hard to follow. They get confusing. They change all of the time. And unfortunately, a lot of them are based on faulty science or on science that has not been proven. And so I try very hard not to tell people what diet to eat. I would not advocate for any of the diets or for, you know, low carb or low fat or anything else. I think there are a host of options that people could take that would all fall into the realm of healthy eating. And if they work for you, I'm thrilled. But the idea that someone else can tell you this is the way you should be eating, there's really no evidence for that at all.
Now, Dr. Aaron Carroll, one of the things that you say in the book Bad Food Bible is you say we need to make a distinction between relative risk and absolute risk. I found that so interesting because it really puts into perspective, you know, how we can differentiate whether something's good or bad for us.
Yeah, this comes up all the time, and unfortunately, so relative risk is sort of the percent change from one risk to another based upon a risk factor. It's almost always the scarier number. It is absolutely the one that almost all news stories focus on. Absolute risk is your total change in risk. So when I say your risk can go up by 50%, that could mean going up from you know, 20% to 30%, it could also mean going up from 1.0002% to 1.0003%. Those are both a sort of, you know, 50% increase in relative risk. They are really different, however, with respect to absolute risk changes. So I've written a couple columns recently that are also like sort of highlighted in the book, but for instance, alcohol and cancer.
Yeah.
There was a lot of news the last few weeks that talked about the fact that, you know, new guidelines are being put out that said any alcohol increases your risk of cancer. You have to be concerned that even light drinking can increase your risk. And if I remember correctly, even with the light drinking, the risk for breast cancer went up by 4%. Okay, 4% sounds like a lot. But of course, you have to look at the change in absolute risk. So a 40-year-old woman has an absolute risk of something like 1.45% of getting breast cancer. Therefore, if that goes up by 4%, it only goes up to like 1.51. That's a very, very small change in your overall risk, not nearly as scary. But news stories were highlighting, oh, well, this risk could go up by 500%. But that was going up from like less than 1 to still less than 1. And so if you focus too much on the relative risk and not on the absolute risk, you can overperceive the danger. And that is often what the news will do, unfortunately, in covering medical studies, especially studies of nutrition, in hyping up the results and getting you scared. You have to be really thoughtful, however, of the absolute risk. What is the real number by which this will change? And almost always that's barely changing with respect to any risk factor, because of course if something was a huge change in risk, in your absolute risk, we'd know. We would have seen it already. It wouldn't need elucidation. We would know that people that drink alcohol would be at vastly increased risk of many of these problems, and that doesn't happen.
What would you say to somebody who's maybe already had breast cancer? Should they never drink alcohol, or is the same thing apply, absolute versus relative risk?
So every woman has to apply her risk differently. So when you talk about relative risk, it's changing your absolute risk. So if you knew that you were at very, very, very high risk for breast cancer, be it through family history or because something else going on, then you might know that light drinking, moderate drinking, and certainly heavy drinking, which is terrible, no one advocates, might all change your risk factor differently than the average woman. But even then, you still have to be careful about how it's being applied, because unless the studies were of your exact population, then trying to generalize some of the studies to you are also problematic. And even then, you have to weigh your own benefits and harms, because lots of these activities have benefits other than what we're studying, and lots of them have harms other than what we're studying. With respect to alcohol, for instance, alcohol in general does increase your risk of some cancers. Theoretically, though, if you look at those same kinds of studies, it limits risk of other cancers. Moreover, those same kinds of studies show that alcohol reduces the risk of heart disease and diabetes. And again, this is in safe amounts. And the benefits with respect to heart disease and diabetes outweigh the harms with respect to cancer. So people actually have lower mortality or risk of dying among those who drink lightly or moderately than people who don't. Now, I'm not advocating that people should just go out and start drinking if they don't, but if you buy into the methodology that shows that alcohol increases your risk of some cancers, you have to buy the same methodology that shows that it provides benefits that outweigh those harms with other diseases. And a nuanced conversation would accept all of this together, as well as the fact that it's perfectly legitimate to accept a slightly tiny higher risk of a bad outcome for something that perhaps increases your quality of life or provides you with joy. The best example I can give is the number one killer of children in the United States by far is accidents. And it's car accidents are almost always the number one killer. No one advocates that to reduce this risk, no one should ever drive. We accept that a certain number of children, in fact, more children than almost anything else that's going to kill them, are going to die because the quality of life benefits from driving outweigh that risk. That we see such societal benefits that we will accept a certain number of children dying every year. We can have that kind of nuanced acceptance when it comes to cars, but often when it comes to food, that kind of nuance goes out the window. We say, oh, if there's any danger at all, we must completely abstain from it. We cannot consider that there might be reasonable gains in quality of life or some other factor that would allow us rationally to accept that level of harm.
And talking about being rational about harm, you also talk about coffee, which for so many years, I mean, I can remember my mother just not drinking coffee, which she loved, for the last 10 years of her life because she was afraid it was going to, you know, increase her blood pressure problems. So, but you say coffee is really good for you.
Yeah, this is one that baffles me, and I'm as surprised as anyone else when I really sort of dug into the research, because coffee is really considered a vice. People think it either dehydrates you, or it raises your blood pressure, or makes you hyperactive, or, you know, it needs to be avoided, you get addicted to it. And almost every kind of study you could look at, you see that coffee is associated with significant benefits, that people do better with respect to cancer, with respect to liver disease, with respect to neurologic disease, that people that drink coffee seem to do better than people who do not. And we're not talking about minimal amounts of coffee. Some of these studies go up to 5, 6, 7, almost 8 cups a day. And so there's almost no evidence that shows that coffee is dangerous, and an unbelievable huge amount of evidence that shows it's associated with positive health outcomes. So I wish, as with many chapters in this book, people would stop demonizing the food and accept that often there's a potential associative positive benefit, but at the least we should stop treating these foods as if they're bad or harmful or get moral about them or talk to other people that tend to enjoy them and act as if they're doing something wrong or harming themselves.
Now, one thing you don't talk about with coffee that I had a question about is I have heard that coffee will leach calcium from the bones. Is this another scientific canard?
I think I might even have, I can't remember if I hit that, but no, that's another myth. They say the same thing often of soda as well. So what they will do is they will find some studies that show in the short term, if you drink coffee, that there are some very, very short-term changes in the kidney that, you know, we will see an increase in calcium excretion or we see an increase in water excretion, and then people leap to the idea of like, oh, therefore it's draining your bones or it's making you dehydrated. Of course, your body, including your kidneys, are incredibly good at, you know, changing what they do based upon inputs. And so while there might be a very short-term increase in some of this excretion, then the kidneys adapt and they slow it down so that your overall excretion does not change. And so it's misreading or misinterpreting many of these studies that lead you to believe that these substances are dangerous or they're causing harm in some way. The long-term, overall, more thorough, more sophisticated studies do not find these dangers, especially with respect to coffee, where, as I said, the overwhelming evidence is that it's associated with positive, good health outcomes. If any other kind of supplement had the weight of evidence behind it that coffee did, we would almost treat it like a miracle drug. It is just baffling to me that coffee in general is still considered a vice.
So I wanted to ask you a little bit about organic foods. You basically take the position that organic foods and conventionally grown foods are pretty equivalent to each other in terms of health and safety. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the pesticides, because for many years I worked in the field of occupational health and safety, and I know the pesticides are actually bad for you, and and I'm sure you wouldn't disagree with that. The question is, how much, you know, how bad are they for you if they are getting on your vegetables? And I know that, you know, there are organizations out there that put out lists of vegetables that are safe to get non-organically and other ones that are not so safe because pesticide levels are high. And you list that, you know, these were not seen, that they were under the maximum allowed safety limits. And that's where I wanted to kind of challenge you a little bit, because those safety limits tend to be, you know, a mix of science and politics.
There's no question that is true, but it's also important to recognize that often when those lists are put out, they're not being put out by scientific studies with peer review that we all know what's going on. A lot of times these kinds of things are just released with no kind of oversight or anything else, and the people releasing them have an agenda just as much as the people who might release data point in the opposite way. When we look at the true research that we have, and it does exist, there have been systematic reviews of looking at the safety and the nutritional content of organic foods that are massive, again, with hundreds of studies within them. And it is true that there's a difference sometimes in what is measured with respect to pesticides or herbicides with respect to organic or non-organic foods, but they fall well below those limits. It's not that they're skirting up against them. They're really, really low. Second, they're often almost always measuring certain pesticides and not others. No one should be under the illusion that every organic pesticide is safe. In fact, the way in which they determine if a pesticide or herbicide is organic or not has nothing to do with safety. It has to do with sort of how it is created. And many of them are very harmful. We just sort of allow it because we expect that organic food in general is also using them in better amounts, but that's not nearly as closely watched as people think either. I'm not trying to say organic food is unsafe. I'm just trying to say that when they do the head-to-head studies and they look at it, you can't find these major changes in safety. When you especially look at actual health outcomes, there's no difference, again, between what is produced by people who eat organic food and what is produced by people who eat conventionally grown foods. Now, again, if people want to debate the ethics or the way in which organic food or farming is safer for the environment, I'm totally fine with that. But with respect to health, there's no evidence that one is safer or more nutritious than the other. And this is after looking at hundreds and hundreds of studies together. Well, here's the thing. Mm-hmm. I'm so thrilled if someone wants to eat a fruit or a vegetable. I don't understand attacking someone who's doing so for doing it wrong. We have such a steep climb in getting people to eat healthy in general, to then turn around and say to the people who are even trying to eat healthy that they're still not doing it right, and when that organic food might cost significantly more, seems to go against what we need. I would rather us just be thrilled people are eating fruits and vegetables or other food in general that we consider healthy than to quibble about the relative safety or not.
Well, I think those are all really very important points, but I do have one study, and I wanted to see if you had maybe had seen it and what you think of it,
sure.
That said that sperm counts have been going down worldwide for the last mm-hmm. 50 or 60 years, and there have been studies, and I don't know how good or bad they are, according to the very important guidelines that you put out in this book, in the Bad Food Bible. But there have been studies that showed that sperm counts there were significant differences between people who ate organic food, men who ate organic food versus men who did not. Have you seen those studies?
So, yes. So there's a couple of ways that I'd respond to that. The first is to say that they are showing you statistically significant difference, but not necessarily clinically significant differences, in the sense that they did not show that those men could not have children or were at significant risk for not reproducing with respect to other men. The second thing is that those studies could be confounded in any number of ways because, again, they're not randomized controlled trials, which said, okay, let's take a group of men and give some men organic food and some men non-organic food, and let's see if their sperm counts change. That kind of trial is one, doable, and two, has not been done. And if people truly have this concern, we could test this, but that either has been done and has not shown a difference, and therefore didn't get published and didn't make news, or has not been shown. So we are not seeing that people's uptake of non-organic or organic foods are leading to sperm count differences that actually are changing birth rates in any of these countries that we can detect. If there were, again, we could do trials to see if we could either change that or counteract it. Those are doable and ethical. And if somebody wants to do that and prove me wrong, I'm more than happy to take it. And until then, again, I'm not going to start pushing people to pay more for food, especially poor people, on something which has not been proven.
Well, Dr. Aaron Carroll, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
Aaron Carroll is a doctor and a contributor to the New York Times Upshot column. Next up, what's up with processed food, even if it's organic? Stay tuned after the break.
Food!
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. If you think buying organic from Whole Foods is protecting you, you're wrong. Our food, even what we're told is good for us, has changed for the worse in the past 100 years. Its nutritional content is deteriorating due to industrial farming and even climate change. Its composition has been altered due to the addition of thousands of chemicals from pesticides to packaging. We simply no longer know what we're eating. In her book, formerly known as Food, Kristen Lawless says that because of the degradation of our diet, our bodies are literally changing from the inside out. The billion-dollar food industry is reshaping our food preferences, altering our brains, changing the composition of our microbiome, and even affecting the expression of our genes. An independent journalist and nutrition expert, Lawless presents a comprehensive explanation of the problem. She goes beyond nutrition to issues of food choice, class, race, and gender. And she provides a sound and simple philosophy of eating. She calls it the whole egg theory. Well, Kristen Lawless, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Now, this book, formerly known as Food, is that a quote from Michael Pollan?
Not quite. He did refer to food like substances, so it's a related idea, obviously.
So, formerly known as Food, that's a very intriguing title. How the industrial food system is changing our minds, bodies, and culture. And I almost thought that that culture might be a double entendre, because you also talk about how it's changing our microbiome.
Right, that's true. That's true.
Well, you start the book with something that you call the whole egg theory. What is that theory?
That's the idea that any food we eat should be whole and intact, like the whole egg. And I use the egg as a good visual because for years we've been told to either, you know, not eat eggs, only eat the white, or even worse, eat something like egg beaters, which is this highly industrial product. But it turns out much of that information was wrong. The yolk is where much of the nutrition is. And so when you think of a whole food, you can think of the whole egg and then you can apply it to anything else. So something like steak with the fat on it and chicken with the skin, any kind of vegetable should be in its whole state. And instead, what most people are eating are highly processed, refined foods, which have been stripped of much of their nutrition.
Chicken with its skin, isn't that a problem with, you know, contaminants?
Well, right. So even the concept of the whole food is now tainted by the industrialization of the food supply. So then you start getting into issues of how was the chicken raised, what was it fed, what was it treated with in the plant. So, right, it goes on and on when you're thinking about all the factors of industrialization of our food.
Now, you mentioned steak with the fat on, and
yeah.
You talked about eggs. Of course, that has us thinking about cholesterol. Talk about the new ideas about fat and cholesterol that you explore in this book, formerly known as Food.
Well, since about the 1950s, there was this concept of the lipid hypothesis or the cholesterol hypothesis, and that was the idea that the fats and cholesterol in the food would then make you fat. So doctors and researchers, they were finding plaques in the arteries, and that was cholesterol. So they sort of made the assumption that whatever we ate, if it had fat or cholesterol, it would then result in these kinds of plaques or cause other kind of chronic disease. But what we're learning now is it's not really true. And in fact, what seems to be causing things like heart disease, diabetes, obesity, all these chronic diseases is the highly refined processed nature of the food. And what the science is showing more and more now is it's not fat that's the problem. It's sugars, refined carbohydrates, highly processed vegetable oils, all of the components that make up what's in the processed foods.
So this vegetable oils, that was a big surprise to me. I count myself as a pretty, you know, conscious consumer of food, and I try to eat whole foods and organic and pasture raised and humanely certified food. I thought vegetable oils are supposed to be good for you. So tell us about that.
Yeah, this is something I think surprises a lot of people. But again, this went hand in hand with that lipid hypothesis. So instead of eating the natural traditional fats that humans have eaten for thousands of years, we were told to switch to highly processed vegetable oils. And for example, margarine. Margarine's made up of processed vegetable oils, but also like Wesson corn oil or canola oil, these things were promoted as heart healthy for a very long time. Well, in the book, I talked to this researcher, Fred Kumro. He recently died at age 103, and he was sounding the alarm on margarine, which was, trans fats. We had for years telling us to eat trans fats instead of butter because it would prevent heart disease, but now we know, and this is, you know, this is completely backed by all the agency, the health agencies now, trans fats actually cause heart disease. So the thing they were telling us to eat in place of butter was in fact causing more harm than good. So now Fred Kummerow, when I spoke to him before he died, when I was researching my book, he was telling me he's also really concerned about the vegetable oils. And not only do people use them in their kitchens because they think they're healthy, but they're in nearly all processed foods. So you might think, oh, I don't eat many vegetable oils. But when you look at the labels on boxes, you'll see things like soybean oil or corn oil, canola oil, even organic foods has them. Sometimes you'll see organic safflower oil or sunflower oil. What Fred Kummerow told me is that these oils are highly susceptible to oxidation. So they're very unstable. So think of like butter. Butter is solid at room temperature. That means it has stable bonds in its structure. With vegetable oils, it's liquid. So those are unstable oils, which means they're subject to rancidity and oxidation. So oxidized fats, we know, harm the arterial lining, and that can lead to things like heart disease. So this is something that I think many people don't know, but you need to be aware of it because it's in so many of our foods.
How about your own home use if you keep vegetable oils in the refrigerator? Is that okay? And are there some that are better than others?
The only vegetable oil that I think should be used is olive oil. Olive oil is something that humans have eaten for a very long time. Otherwise, I use butter. I recommend using butter. Even lard, which was, you know, has been demonized for years, lard is actually a healthful fat. It's a blend of fats. It's not just saturated fat. It actually has monounsaturated fat in it as well. So stick to the traditional fats that humans have been eating. There's another researcher, a nutrition researcher at UC Davis, who told me that if you look throughout human history across all cultures, these vegetable oils are essentially brand new, with the exception of olive oil. So stick to the ones that we've been eating for a very long time.
And I guess I'll just ask one more. What about coconut oil? Because so many people think that's healthy.
Right.
Is that
also? Coconut oil, I like coconut oil. And I think, again, this is a more stable oil. And it's a good idea if you're going to be cooking at high heat. You can use something like coconut oil. It's also, it can be used for baking. So, yeah, coconut oil, pretty helpful.
So give us the complete definition of processed food.
Processed food, so when you think about what's in all the grocery stores, look at anything that's in a package, it's been stripped. All of its nutrition has basically been taken away. I mean, I think a good thing to think about is like sliced bread in the grocery store. We think of that, probably many people think, oh, that's a simple whole food. But with typical grocery store sliced bread, if you look at the list of ingredients, first of all, the wheat, you know, wheat is a grain that humans have been eating for a very long time. When it's whole, it's helpful. But what happened is they stripped it to make white flour because white flour was preferred over the darker, you know, the darker kinds of flours. But that strips it of all its nutrition. And then you think about what's being added to the wheat, the chemicals that are sprayed on it in the fields. For example, Roundup. People have heard of Roundup. Monsanto makes it. The main ingredient is glyphosate, which is an herbicide. Many studies, which I talk about in the book, have shown links to various cancers. And all the wheat, much of the wheat in this country is actually sprayed with Roundup because it's a drying agent and it gets the wheat from field to market quicker, so it's increased profits. Well, there's a lot of residue that ends up on the wheat. So again, we're talking about not only stripping the food of its nutrition, but then what's been added to it. And then I also talk about in the book all the plastic packaging that's involved in our foods today. And so much of that, the chemicals that are found in that plastic packaging migrates into the food. So when you think of processed foods, it's not just one thing. It's first, stripping of its nutrition. Second, all the additives that are added to the crop that was grown. Then the plastic packaging. And then on top of that, whatever food additives were, you know, kinds of like preservatives and colorings and all these other things that are added to the foods.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist Kristen Lawless about her book, formerly known as Food. Yeah, you say also that we're not getting the same kind of nutrition that our grandparents or great-grandparents did.
Right. So that's another layer. You know, since the 1950s, with the advent of industrial agriculture, what happened was much of the soil has been depleted of the nutrition. When the soil lacks the components needed to make healthy plants, obviously those plants are going to have far less nutrition than they did before industrial agriculture. So there are studies to show the deterioration of the nutritional quality of even basic staple, you know, fruits and vegetables.
And add to that, I think I read something, I believe it was yesterday, that was really scary, that climate change is also robbing our fruits and vegetables of their nutritional content.
Right.
Do you know about that?
Yeah, I did see that article too. And again, I mean, when you think about the interconnectedness of all these issues, because industrial agriculture is one of the biggest contributors to greenhouse emissions. So I think people often forget that what we do to the environment, we then do to ourselves, because we're obviously part of that environment. So, you know, important to keep in mind that. That's why in the book, I make a strong argument for it not being about coming down to, you know, individual buying patterns. It has to be a bigger picture we're talking about here.
Yeah, and kind of on that note, talk about milk first, conventional milk, but then let's talk about organic milk.
So I take some time with this in the book, again, because I think that people assume milk, you know, in the store, that's a simple whole food. It should be. But with industrialization, what we've seen is it's basically not anymore. When I mentioned, you know, fats in the beginning, I tell people to only buy whole milk, because low-fat and fat-free milk is not a whole food. That's not how it comes out of a cow, and the fat is where much of the nutrition is. Fat-soluble vitamins like A and D are in the fatty part of the milk or cream or butter. You know, for years we've been told to avoid that, but much to our detriment because of, you know, missing out on those vital nutrients. So, and then there's the question of packaging again, in even organic milk, say. Much of it comes in a plastic bottle or a paper carton, and those cartons are often lined with something that's like a plastic derivative. And what I really detail in the book is how these chemicals are harming us and our children and even fetuses in the womb because of what scientists call estrogenic activity in many plastics. So these are chemicals that sort of mimic hormones in the body, like estrogen, for example, and then have a similar effect in the body when they shouldn't be there. So it's we're getting these chemicals when we wouldn't naturally get them. So, you know, again, even organics, it's problematic.
You call them in the book endocrine-disrupting chemicals, or
right.
EDCs. You know, yesterday I was reading an article about how the men's rights movement is up in arms because they're saying that sperm counts are being lowered because men are being feminized by feminism. Which is like, and the strange thing, even though the article, you know, was written in such a way so that you knew that the reporter wasn't buying that argument,
mm-hmm.
neither did the reporter point to endocrine disrupting chemicals as the potential cause for the steep drop in men's sperm counts, so much so that you say in this book, Kristen Lawless, and formerly known as Food, that by 2060, men in industrial countries, the majority of men may be infertile.
Right. So that's very alarming, to say the least. But right, so these chemicals are really, really scary. And when I talk to a lot of researchers in the book, and they're looking at all of these issues, and sadly, the regulatory agencies in this country, so like the FDA and the EPA, which broadly speaking oversee most of what goes into the food, including not only what goes into like food additives and food packaging, but also the EPA looks at things like pesticides and herbicides and fungicides and how, you know, that gets into our food, obviously, and into our bodies. But they're not really carefully looking at the science around endocrine disruption for a number of reasons that I talk about in the book. But there are independent scientists in many universities doing this work, and they are really alarmed. And so this was something I really want readers to know about and, you know, spread the word about, because I think it tends to fly under the radar, but they're seeing these very strong, you know, issues in animal studies, like you mentioned, the sperm count, but also things like breast cancer and prostate cancer, infertility in women too, things like endometriosis and all kinds of fertility disorders. Then when pregnant women are exposed, fetuses in the womb, you know, during these very crucial windows of development in the fetus are being disrupted by these chemicals. And then that's the same too when babies are exposed in children. And I see so many babies and children, you know, eating foods out of plastic containers, and parents often don't know. You know, it's not their fault, because how would you know, you know? And I really think it's something we need to be more aware of.
Right. And back to milk and organic milk and organic food in general, you know, one of the things you talk about is how high ultra-pasteurization is disrupting the fat structure, the structure mm-hmm. of the fat molecules, in such a way that maybe even contributing to our obesity epidemic.
Right. There's a couple issues with milk. So milk is typically homogenized and pasteurized. Pasteurization means like heating, but you often see things like, I think it's called ultra-pasteurized, and this is very high temperatures. And so the milk is basically rendered inert. You know, milk is like a living substance full of bacteria that's beneficial to your health, but when it's heated to such a high degree, everything is basically killed in it. That means it can be kept on the shelf for months, even without refrigeration. But that damages the structure of the milk. The other thing is homogenization. So most milk, when it naturally separates, it's called like cream line milk sometimes, and the milk separates. But when in industrialization, they homogenize it, so it's all one uniform texture. People are used to it. It works better for other kinds of applications. But that damages the milk molecule, the fat molecule in the milk. And so this one dairy farmer I talked to in the books was really concerned about damaging the milk molecule, which again leads to oxidization, which I mentioned earlier with the vegetable oils. Oxidized fats, which is what you're getting with homogenized milk, seem to cause damage to the arteries. And so that's another way that we're seeing these kinds of foods contribute to chronic disease.
So you also speak in the book, Kristen Lawless, you speak in Formerly Known as Food, How the Industrial Food System is Changing Our Minds, Bodies, and Culture. You talk about the organic industrial complex, so that it really matters where we are getting our organic food.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I give the example of like Earthbound Organics, which is one company that is a huge company and grows huge, vast, you know, swaths of foods like broccoli, for example. So those kinds of organics are much different than the kinds of organics you'll get from if you can patronize a local organic farmer who has a farm that has very, you know, different kinds of crops, not just one. With Earthbound, for example, broccoli is grown on monocrop scale, so that means it's just one crop, and that has the effect of depleting the soil also. And they're not caring for the land and the biodiversity of the land in the same way that your small-scale organic farmer. And so I talked to some of the local farmers that I get much of my produce from at my farmer's market, and they don't consider that stuff organic, because they're like, it's all about the soil. And if you're not getting the nutrients in the soil, they're not going to come through to the plants, and then they're not going to get into your body. So it's a far different kind of, you know, that's why there's different, you know, shades of organics, and we need to be more mindful of that, I think, if we want to make, you know, good decisions about our food.
And then there's the whole issue with the microbiome, which I mentioned up at the start of this interview. You know, we've heard a lot about the microbiome and how crucial the health of it is to our own health. You talk about how certain beneficial bacteria that we evolved with and are absolutely crucial to us are now extinct in many people, in perhaps most 97% of people in industrialized countries. Talk about this issue and if there's anything we can do about it.
This was one of the most shocking findings for me in the book, and this is research coming out of UC Davis. And what they found is this one strain of bacteria, it's called B. infantis, which has been in the infant gut for all of our evolution is now extinct in the Western world. And they think it's extinct for three main reasons, one being the rise in C-section, so the baby's not being exposed to the bacteria in the natural delivery, two, the overuse of antibiotics. It's a fragile species, and with all the antibiotics we've had over the course of generations, it's been killed off. And then the third thing, and really importantly, it's the use of infant formula. Infant formula doesn't contain this type of carbohydrate. It's called an oleosaccharide that feeds this bacteria. It's found in breast milk. And in fact, that's how they discovered this missing species, was that when they were studying the components of breast milk, they found that it was oleosaccharides, this carbohydrate, is the third most abundant component of breast milk. But babies cannot digest it. And so they were wondering why it would be there if a baby couldn't digest it. And it turns out that is feeding the bacteria, not the baby. And so the researcher at UC Davis, Bruce German, said, you know, this was like this astounding realization. You know, it's as important to feed the bacteria for the baby's health as it is to just feed the baby. So we've basically wiped out this bacteria over the course of about 2 to 3 generations. And this bacteria is highly protective. What it does is it basically replicates and colonizes the entire lower intestine of the baby. And what it does is crowds out pathogens or bad bugs, and it protects the baby not only from acute illness but from long-term chronic disease. This is what they're starting to try to figure out. But yeah, we've completely rendered that extinct. What we can do about it, at UC Davis, they're working on something that they could potentially introduce on a population-wide scale, reintroduce it to the population, because it's like a seed. You have to be inoculated, or, you know, you have to plant it in the body in order for it to replicate, since it doesn't exist anymore. And I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times about a month ago about this idea and reintroducing it to the population. So hopefully that's something that can be done.
But if it needs breast milk to flourish, how are we going to do that?
Well, it's only really for infants, what we have to encourage, and something else I've written quite a bit about, is breastfeeding and the ability for, you know, women to breastfeed. We need paid maternity leave. We need to not only reintroduce the bacteria, but then provide the social support women need in order to be able to breastfeed their babies, to be able to feed this bacteria, which is protective for lifelong health.
And didn't Trump just recently, his administration came out against breastfeeding and in fact ended a program that promoted breastfeeding?
They're trying to water down a resolution at the UN about promoting breastfeeding internationally, because we know that breastfeeding saves lives, especially in poor countries. And we know that breastfeeding has tons of health benefits for everyone. But yes, because the infant formula companies are huge, I mean, they're huge lobbying presence. It's a $70 billion industry worldwide. They want to promote their product. They make a lot of money off of their product. And so Trump and his allies were trying to water down this resolution that would continue to promote it. That's a tragedy, actually.
And did they succeed?
Well, I don't think they really succeeded to the degree that they wanted to, because the international health community was just so appalled at the idea of it, because it's just such a well-known fact at this point that breastfeeding saves lives, and we need to promote it as best we can.
Right, and we should point out that some of the impacts you talked about, you mentioned long-term impacts, those include things like autoimmune diseases and allergies and autism. And perhaps, you know, I mean, if the immune system is compromised, then that sets up inflammation and can lead to cancer.
Of course. And I actually wrote another op-ed about this for The Guardian, and that same researcher at UC Davis, Bruce German, says that, you know, we should have understood the benefits of mother's milk just decades ago and promoted it better. But science in this country and many other industrialized countries has been focused on the diseases of middle-aged, rich white men, instead of looking at the mother and child. And he thinks that this is the key to understanding nutrition. Obviously, mother's milk is the one perfect food that we've evolved to, you know, to be able to replicate over the course of millennia. And so he refers to breast milk as the Rosetta Stone for understanding nutrition. And so the irony of all this is, of course, is that if we would focus on that and be able to promote it, those diseases of middle-aged, rich white men would probably come down quite a bit because it is implicated in things like diabetes and heart disease.
So you mentioned the idea of paid leave. That's just one of the recommendations you make. You talk about the need to democratize the food supply. Tell us what you mean by that, and also tell us about some of the other ways in which we can tackle this problem right now.
One of my big arguments in the book is that what's called the food movement has been primarily focused on consumer choice and personal responsibility. And in many ways, that echoes the industrial food system. Their big thing is eat everything in moderation. You know, if you don't like one food, you're free to buy a different kind of food. This idea is problematic because most people, or many Americans, don't have access to those kinds of foods, can't afford those kinds of foods, which are more expensive. And what that's done is created kind of two food systems, one for people who can afford these, you know, organic, sustainable kinds of foods and have access to them, and then the rest of Americans who often have to rely on convenience, fast food, processed foods. And that's for a number of reasons. It's not just about what's available to them, but it's because people are working for longer hours for less pay. And that means that people don't have the skill anymore. It's something that's been lost over the course of generations, is understanding how to cook and shop and prepare foods. The research on that is kind of alarming, too. I think the average American spends maybe 30 minutes a day, all told, in the kitchen. So there's not much that can be done in that time, but most people don't have the time. And so the kind of solutions I'm talking about are things like, we need to have a real education, like home ec, but better, and on how to cook food, how to shop for food. We could think about how we could educate kids on where foods come from. This could be part of the curriculum and a really important part of it. I also talk about having a federal farm program that would link up. There's so many people around the country doing really interesting, amazing work with urban farming and gardening, but we don't have a federal program to support it. And I feel like if we had one that could link up all these people doing this important work, we could have kind of a movement to create more agriculture in the cities and also provide more green space in the cities, something else we really need. I'd like to see advertising for harmful foods curtailed. I think there should be a warning label on many of these foods because, like I said, many people don't know what's in them and that they are harmful to themselves and to their children. So, yeah, I have a manifesto at the end of the book that outlines all of this.
And it is a terrific book. And this has been just a fascinating conversation. Kristen Lawless, the book is formerly known as Food, How the Industrial Food System is Changing Our Minds, Bodies, and Culture. Thank you so much for not only speaking with us, but also for writing this important book.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on.
Kristen Lawless. Read her new food manifesto and find links to her articles at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.